Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you register for next year's Here We Still Stand conference. Now, I'm not going to beat you over the head with registering for conferences all year long. I know that I just got done talking a lot about conferences. We got two coming up that you can register for. You can register for the regional event, the regional Here We Still Stand event. It's a two-day event in beautiful, glorious Northwest Arkansas, Bentonville to be exact. That is May 5th and 6th. Come and hang out. It'll be good. Chad's going to be there. I'm going to be there. It's going to be a good time. Come out to the Ozarks in the spring. You can find that event over at 1517.org on the events page. You can also find next year's National Conference, which is in October in San Diego. We just got finished with that. It was a blast. Chad and I have spent a little bit of time talking about it as we record this episode. And what a great time. If you've not been, you need to go. It was a blast. It's in a beautiful hotel in a beautiful part of the country. So come hang out. We're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis and the Untamed God. It's going to be a good time. You can get all the information over at 1517.org. Chad, Here We Still Stand was a blast. This is the first time we're recording. I know like it's been a few weeks since, you know, since the conference ended by the time this comes out, but this is the first time we're sitting down to record since that happened, which was just this last weekend. And yeah, if you've not been, if someone's listening to this and they've thought about going, man, you got to go.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. We were just talking to my daughter last night. She's in town, and you know, just going on about how awesome it was. She's like, "All right, I'm going next year."
Yeah, there's nothing else like so, it, man.
She wants to be there, and I tell people that all the time. You've gotta go. I mean, it is the highlight of my year. I mean, not only because the speakers are great, and you know, like you said, beautiful surroundings, but also it is kind of like a reunion. You get together with friends, you meet new friends. It's a wonderful time to be together with people who care so much about the gospel, and the fact that you get to do that, you know, in San Diego,
right?
It's just the icing on the cake.
So. Yeah. So we won't beat you over the head every time we record, but since we just got back, and since you can register right now, and you want to get that early bird pricing. I mean, right now is the cheapest time you're going to get to register for it. So register for that. And also, while you're at it, register for the Northwest Arkansas event. Come to both. We'd love to see you there. All right, let's get into this. We are in 2 Kings chapter 10. Yehu has gone on a rampage. He's been just taking care of people left and right, been convincing people to out themselves as relatives of people he wants to take out. He goes around telling people that previous people were just small, puny little worshipers of Baal, but he's going to put on a worship service for Baal that no one's ever going to forget, and he's going to have a sacrifice of all sacrifices, which turns out to be the prophets of Baal. And so he has just gone on a rampage of rooting out idolatry. Yeah, this is the thing that's weird about Yehu, is you're like, this guy has got to be more zealous for the pure worship of the Lord than anyone that's ever come before him. I mean, you've never seen anyone go to these lengths. I mean, this guy has got to be, of all the people that we've heard of that are actual kings, this has got to be the most Yahweh alone guy that we have ever encountered, which makes this next section, I got to be honest, Chad, it makes it a little weird.
It is very weird. Yeah, I mean, the whole setup is like, this guy knows no boundaries. I mean, if it's for Yahweh, he's going to do it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no line he will not cross to make sure that everybody knows that Baal is out and Yahweh is in. So it is quite jarring. It's even jarring when you read verse 28, 2 Kings 10, 28, and then the very next verse. So right after, he has the great worship service for Baal that you were talking about.
Yeah, turns their temple into a bathroom.
Yeah, it turns it into a bathroom. So, oh gosh, yeah. So it's a bathroom now. Used to be a Baal temple. So you read about that. Okay, very very next verse 28. Thus, Yehu wiped out Baal from Israel. Okay, so sure seems all inclusive there, right?
I'm about to be 12 years old, but so in verse 27, you have they demolished the pillar of Baal, they demolished the house of Baal, and made it into a latrine, a restroom, a toilet. To this day, thus Jehu wiped out Baal. Now I just feel like this toilet and this wiped are connected.
Yeah. Yeah, I think maybe the ESV translators were like having a little giggle session while they were translating these words.
I like it. I think it's good.
You know, the perfect verb, English verb to translate shamad, which is the Hebrew verb there, would be, you know, rather than saying he demolished Baal or he destroyed, well, let's translate it, he wiped out Baal from Israel.
Wipe
That's
him out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it is. It's a well done translation.
Yeah.
So. Now that's verse 28. Listen to verse 29. But anytime you know we have the but, you know something surprising about to happen. But Jehu, you know what he didn't do? He did not turn aside from the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. That is the golden calves that were in Bethel and in Dan. I don't get it.
No.
I mean, you wipe out so many people that are connected with the worship of Baal. I mean, you even wipe out people from the southern kingdom that are sort of associated with the king that you just took out. You have this grand worship service to Baal in which you slaughter all these worshipers of Baal, turn that into a toilet, wipe out Baal from Israel. But you get to the golden calves, you're like, that's a little bit too far for me. I just can't see taking out the golden calf in Dan and the golden calf in Bethel.
Which is wild.
This is just
because that's
strange.
That's like original OG idolatry.
Yeah, this is like the original sin of the northern kingdom right here.
Yeah.
Are the golden calves.
It's the original sin of all the way back to like golden calves, dude. Like this is like the original, hey, let's walk away from the Lord and have an idol. Before Baal, you had golden calf, dude. Like this is wild to me.
Yeah, it's like this should have been number one priority before you start taking out all these other worshipers of Baal. How about we take out the golden calves? You know, we can chop off the branches later. Let's get at the very root first,
dude.
We are dealing with humanity here, so humanity is, if anything, fickle and inconsistent when it comes to fidelity.
Dude, if you walked into someone's house and they had like a little statue to Baal, you would not know what that was. They'd have to tell you what it was before you were like really concerned and horrified. If you walked into somebody's house and they had a golden calf in there, you would know immediately. You'd be like, what is happening, right? What is going on? Like, oh yeah, that's just our God over there. That's crazy. That's a golden, like the golden calf is, you know, I mean, I assume Yehu's a Bible guy as much as you can be a Bible guy at this time, right? I mean, so I'm assuming he, you know, maybe he's read a little bit of Moses or something like that. How is this not, like, that's just wild to me. Like, when I think of idolatry, I think of golden calves.
Yeah. So whatever the reason, and all I can chalk it up to is, like I said, the fickle inconsistency of human fidelity. So he did not take him out. And so here's what God says to him. This is verse 30. The Lord said to Jehu, because you have done well in carrying out what is right in my eyes and have done to the house of Ahab, according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. So that's pretty, I mean, that's something that no other northern king is given. So we've seen already multiple examples of just how bad all the northern kings were, beginning with Jeroboam and then working all the way down, especially in the Omri dynasty with Ahab and whatnot. So this is going to be a promise that is very unique. It's kind of it's like an echo, sort of a distant echo of the promises given to the Davidic dynasty. And we read later, a couple more chapters, actually five more chapters in 2 Kings 15:12, that's what happened. So after Yehu is gone, then you have Jehoahaz, you have Jehoash, you have Jeroboam II, you have Zechariah. All these are the descendants of Yehu. So he is given sons to sit on the throne to the fourth generation. Now, none of them are going to be like him as far as his zeal goes, but God is faithful to his promise. So he did well in carrying out God's wishes, even though those wishes, of course, were mixed with his own mixed motivations for doing things. He did what was right in carrying out the divine punishment, really, divine destruction of those who would engage in such rampant idolatry. Then we have another but, verse 31. But Yehu was not careful to walk in the Torah of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not turn aside from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin. And of course, the sins of Jeroboam, that's the golden calves.
Right.
They embody what this sin was.
You know what this does is it shows you this, and I think the writer here is careful to show you this, because you have this first but, which is, hey, these golden calves, they remained. And then you have this word from God, which is very complimentary to Yehu, and says, hey, you've done everything that was in my heart in regard to the house of Ahab, which, by the way, that's freaky. God's like, that's exactly what I wanted. And you're like, whew.
Yeah, that's a little freaky. Yeah, that's some wrath right there.
Yeah, it's a little freaky. And your sons are going to get to sit on the throne and all this stuff. So you're like, oh, good. And then it's easy to say, but, however, just so you, in case you missed it, there was this problem. So it gives it to you twice. And all it does is it shows you that as zealous as you can be for God, which Jehu certainly was, and as pleasing as you could be to in God's eyes in carrying out his desires, which God says Jehu was, you're still a sinner. Like, you're still an idolater. You still have not done what? You still have not been careful enough to walk in the ways of the Torah. You have not done that. And you might have been pretty careful, but you weren't careful enough. And this all this tells you is that this dude still needs Jesus. Like, this dude still needs a Savior. As zealous as he was, as obedient as he was, as careful as he may have been, probably more careful than all of us, he wasn't careful enough.
Nope. I was thinking of Noah. You know, Noah's no different. I mean, Noah didn't go around massacring a bunch of people like this guy does. But nevertheless, I mean, Noah, he's at the helm of the ship while he watches basically all of humanity, save himself and seven other people, drowned. And you look at what happens post-flood, of course. You have the whole story of the vineyard and the getting drunk and the naked in his tent and cursing his grandson and all of that. I mean, this is the old story, right? No matter how good somebody is, no matter how good David was, no matter how good Solomon was, no matter how good Yehu is, they're all imperfect instruments.
Yep.
Who are going to mess up, I mean, in ways big or small. So they may be a small M Messiah that is an anointed of God, but they need the anointed just as much as anybody does. I mean, we kind of still deal with this today. I mean, we have certain heroes of the faith, people that we look up to, And we all know, especially the older we get, the more we realize the frailty of humanity. We realize, yeah, these people have feet of clay, just like everybody else.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter who your spiritual hero is. Let me tell you, he or she is still in the inside, struggling with the same things that Noah and David and Solomon and Yehu all struggled with. No different than anybody else. Outwardly, perhaps different, but inwardly, fighting the same demons that everybody does. Still needing Jesus just as much as anybody does.
Yeah, you see that play out in any time you get too close to people, or at least too much light is shed on people. This is a weird example, but even people who spend a lot of time and have all the resources to project an image, you take celebrities and you take like Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, like oh, what a cool dude, so creative and talented, and then they get divorced and you end up being like, these two people are a disaster. Right.
Yeah. It's true though. Yeah.
And they are. I mean, you watch that, you're like, wow, that is wild. And by the way, I didn't like tune in and watch a bunch of that, but it's everywhere. You could have missed parts of it anyway.
Yeah, you're like, that is wild.
But probably if someone got too familiar with your life, they would be like, wow, that is wild.
Never meet your heroes, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it's all true. No matter how curated and perfect the image is that is put forward, or even if it's not curated, what we see of people is on the outside and in public and from a distance is not the same person, you know, that's getting ready in the bathroom in the morning, or didn't sleep well and wakes up extremely grumpy, you know, or whatever the situation might be. Everybody has their grievous faults, whether they're a biblical personage or someone sold today. So we got to finish off this chapter. So the end of chapter 10 is where we hear kind of the follow-up to the imperfect situation that Yehu has created. It says, in those days, what happened? The Lord began to chop off. He was cutting off parts of Israel, a little bit here, a little bit there. And how he did this is through our old friend Hazael, the guy that made Elisha cry. Remember when Elisha anointed him and looked at him and is like, you're going to do some bad, bad stuff. So he literally brought tears to the eyes of Elisha as he foresaw what Hazael would do. Well, he defeated them throughout the territory of Israel, from the Jordan eastward, so in the Transjordan area, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites, the Reubenites, the Manassites, from Aroer, which is by the valley of the Arnon, that is Gilead and Bashan. So a lot of these geographical areas are kind of around the Sea of Galilee in the Transjordan area, which would have been easy pickings for the Syrians / Arameans under the reign of Hazael. So you can see how the northern kingdom, they're beginning to lose land. And this is a little window into what will eventually happen down the road when the Assyrians are the big dog and they come in and they, you know, they're exacting tribute from the northern kingdom, and eventually they get tired of the rebellions in the northern kingdom and they just wipe them out. And the little bits and pieces that have been chopped off over time is you have a complete sweep of the northern kingdom and they lose it all. So wrapping it up, the rest of the acts of Yehu and all that he did and all of his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? So Yehu slept with his fathers, they buried him in Samaria, and Jehoahaz, his son, reigned in his place. And we're told that Yehu reigned over Israel and Samaria 28 years. I don't think that we've talked about this. Have we talked about the archaeological find that's connected with Yehu? I don't think that this has come up before, has it? Anyway, if it has, I apologize for repeating myself. But Google this sometime. Look up the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III. And it depicts Yehu. This is not in the Bible. But this big black stone with all these carvings on it, with text as well as pictures. It's called the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III. And it depicts Yehu. And he's on his hands and knees, bowing down, you know, face to the dirt, before that Assyrian king. And the inscription there talks about all this stuff, the silver, gold, that Yehu brought as tribute to the Assyrian king. Now, we don't know why he did. I mean, he is named. I mean, we know it's him in the picture because it's got, like, a name. This is Yehu. So we don't know why he did this. I mean, was he forced to do this? Was he, as it were, trying to get in good with the Assyrians so they would, you know, partner with him and get some of his enemies? Who knows what the reason might be. But we do have this kind of cool bit of extra-biblical archaeological evidence from the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser III, where we have Yehu actually pictured and named bringing tribute before the sky. So, you know, lest you think Yehu is going to be one of these you know, swaggering guys who's never going to take the knee before anybody. Yeah, yeah, there's another side to there's another side to him as well.
For them to make a for them to make a, you know, sort of image of that probably tells you something about him too. It must have been a might have been a rare thing for him to do. Like, whoa, this guy has got a reputation. Look at we have to depict this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. So, kind of a neat detail that we don't know about him from the biblical narrative, but we do know from archaeology. Okay, so chapter 11, 2 Kings 11, introduces us to surprise, surprise. I know everybody, kind of hang on for a minute. This can be shocking, but introduces us to more violence. I know we have seen hardly any of that in Kings, but here we are, more violence. And this is going to be violence that we actually have not seen. It's going to take place in the Southern Kingdom, so we're shifting our space here. We've been in the Northern Kingdom. That's where Yehu was the king. Now we're going to shift to what's happening in the Southern Kingdom. Now, you remember from, I don't know, two episodes ago, whenever it was, that Yehu not only took out the king of the north, but he also took out the king of the south, because they were, you know, they were right there. They were right there together. So Ahaziah was the king of the south, and he was with the northern king, and Yehu kills them both. So, of course, this obviously creates a vacuum in the southern kingdom, right? You need another king. And we also know that Ahaziah was only 23 years old when he died. So he's not going to be old enough to have a grown son who can take over. So at the very least, it's going to be a child of his who's going to have someone kind of, you know, shepherding through them through this process until they're old enough to actually reign on their own. Now, all that being said, what's attempted anyway is to destroy all of his heirs so that his mom can reign in his place. That's who we encounter here at the beginning of chapter 11. Now, when Athaliah is the mother of the king whom Yehu killed, mother of Ahaziah. Now, when Athaliah, the mother of King Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, killed by Yehu, what did she do? She arose and destroyed all the royal family. Literally, she rose and destroyed Kol Zerah Hamamlekah, which is all the seed of the kingdom. In other words, she wanted to make sure that all her grandchildren were dead. Not going to win Grandmother of the Year award, Athaliah. She wants to make sure that everybody that could have the throne is dead and gone. So she's wiping people out left and right, grandsons, granddaughters, killing them all, making a horrific sweep of her sons, you know, whatever kids he had, making sure they're all gone. But thankfully, there was one woman in the royal household who thought and acted fast, and her name is Jehoshaphat. So Jehoshaphat, who's the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah. So she takes one of the king's sons, spares him before the queen, the grandmother queen, can get to him, and she hides him. She steals him away from the king's rooms, and she put him and his nurse in a bedroom, and they hid from Athaliah so that he wouldn't be put to death. And this wasn't just like a temporary deal, because he remained with her in hiding for 6 years in the temple, hidden in the house of the Lord, while Athaliah reigned over the land. So you've got grandma, who is the mother of the dead king, seized an opportunity for her to reign, seizes that opportunity, and to do so, she wipes out all the royal family, with the one exception of Joash. She's also going to be called Jehoash. And his aunt is the one who steals him away, and as we're going to see in just a minute, his uncle is going to help. So his aunt is Jehoshaphat, His uncle, who's high priest, is Jehoiada. And together, these two are going to take care of the boy, make sure he's safe, until finally it's time for them to kind of make the move in order to bring this very young king out of hiding and then have him crowned.
That is some mad queen kind of stuff, right? So that seems like something out of a movie or out of a fantasy novel where someone seizes the opportunity. Throughout history, like, the most dangerous person to be, like, the most dangerous position you could possibly find yourself is, like, heir to a throne.
Yeah, it's a good chance you're going to die or be killed before you actually take that throne.
Yes, it's a very...
And be killed by who? Well, by all the other people who want it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the worst thing to be if you don't make it. I mean, you need to have your head on a swivel if the throne is going to be yours someday.
Yeah, if this was a movie, you could see like they're just switching from scene to scene. You know, the soldiers are killing this child, the soldiers are killing that child, the soldiers are chasing this child. Just a gruesome scene of violence and bloodshed, all in the service of power. Power is a cruel, cruel god. And as we'll see, not just power, but power that's going to be expressed religiously. Power that's not only going to reign, but also power that's going to bring the worship of Baal from the northern kingdom into the southern kingdom to such an extent that, it'll, as we'll see momentarily, there's actually a temple to Baal in Jerusalem. So you have the temple of Yahweh, but then over here, through the work of Athaliah, this cruel queen, you have a temple set up to the worship of Baal right there in the heart of God's city. So we're going to fast forward here for 6 years. So of course he's very young when all this goes down. 6 years later, so 6 + 1, pretty common biblical pattern here. 6 days of creation, seventh day Sabbath. Now we have 6 years of waiting, and we have this seventh year. In the seventh year, Jehoiada, and we're just kind of, his name is just thrown out here at first. We don't even know who he is if we're just like reading this for the first time. Well, who is Jehoiada? He's not been mentioned before. He's the husband of the aunt that hid her nephew away so wouldn't be killed. So he's the husband of Jehoshaphat. And we'll find out in just a minute that he's not only a priest, but he's the high priest. He's going to end up being the tutor of this, has been the tutor of this young king as well. So seventh year, Jehoiada, he orchestrates the takeover, basically. It's a little bit difficult to, it's a little bit smoother in English translation, but in the Hebrew, there's some kind of questionable words, and we're not exactly sure what all went into the preparation for this day. But here's basically what happened. So Jehoiada the priest, the uncle to this kid, he brings the captains of the Karaites. These are like the bodyguard. These are probably people from Crete. So they're foreigners who are, you know, enlisted as bodyguards. So he brings the captains of the Karaites, the guards. He brings them all together, and he makes a pact with them, basically. He cuts a covenant with them. He puts them all under oath in the temple. And then he brings out the king's son. Everybody assumes that the king's son, that the entire family of the king had been wiped out. So nobody knows. They've kept this, you know, top secret. Nobody knows that there's one and only one descendant of the king still alive. So he shows him the king's son. And he says, all right, you realize what a dangerous situation this is. So here's what we're going to do. And he kind of divides them into thirds. So a third of you go over there, a third of you go over there. Puts some people at certain gates. And then at the end of verse 6, it says that some of them are going to guard. Now, the ESV has the palace. The Hebrew there is habayit, which is house. And then it has masa. So literally the house of masa, which they've translated here as palace. I think it's probably an incorrect translation, and some of the commentators I've checked agree. Masa is probably from a word that has to do with like destruction or tearing down. And most of the ones I checked say this is probably a reference to the house of Baal. It's not called directly the house of Baal. It's like a house of destruction or something along those lines. So there's also going to be people guarding the temple of Baal. Anyway, you got people all over the place. This is logistically planned to a T. And then it goes on to say, you know, you get have your weapons in your hand, and be ready. End of verse 8. Be ready when the king comes. Be ready to guard him and make sure that no one is able to get to him. So that's what they do. Verse 9 says, the captains did everything that Jehoiada the priest commanded. So they bring guys in, some who were supposed to be off duty. They bring them in. They give them, verse 10, says, the priest gave to the captains the spears and shields that had been King David's, which had been kept there in the temple. I'm guessing this was a symbolic move. I mean, it's not like these guys weren't armed, right? It's not like the priest says, oh, yeah, by the way, you guys should have spears and shields. These are probably symbolically connected with the reign of King David, kept in the temple, and thus given to these captains as basically symbols of the Davidic dynasty, which had been almost, you know, completely destroyed by the queen mother. So they're provided with these. The guards stand with the weapons in their hand. They're all around the temple. And then verse 12 is what this has all been leading up to. They bring out this seven-year-old kid, the only survivor of the massacred house of this descendant of King David. They bring him out, the king's son. They put a crown on the head of this seven-year-old, and they gave him the testimony. It's probably something like the, it's edut in Hebrew. It's the same word used to describe the, like the tablets of the covenant, the two tablets of the covenant. So they get, maybe they, you know, hand him the tablets of the covenant or something like that. And they gave him the testimony, and they proclaimed him king. They messiahed him. They anointed him. And then they clapped their hands and said, long live the king. So that's the moment. So you got to picture, you know, this isn't just like a small group of people and they're moderately saying, long live the king, long live the king. No, just imagine a huge, huge, very, very loud and public scene of acclamation where there's this child, a seven-year-old child, encircled by all these priests and by all of the guards holding up David's weapons, proclaiming, no doubt, over and over and over, long live the king, long live the king. So made quite a ruckus. Would have been heard probably all over that part of Jerusalem. And one person that hears what's happening is Athaliah, the wicked queen mother, who thought that she had destroyed all the royal seed. So she hears what's going on. And she runs over to the temple where the people are, and then she sees what was happening. She looked, and there was the king standing by the pillar. This is probably one of the two pillars in front of the temple. You know, they even had names. They were called Jachin and Boaz, these two vast temples, two large pillars in front of the temple. That's probably where he's standing there. So she sees the king. She knows he's the king because, of course, he's going to have the crown on his head. And they have the captains. There's trumpeters beside the king. And all the people are not just clapping, but they're rejoicing. They're blowing trumpets. And you can tell Athaliah knows it's all over.
This is not, you know, name as king in secret. See if you can, like, drum up some support. Like, all the work goes in on the front end where this thing is well planned. You're going to make a very public, a coronation here. And you got the support that you need. The remarkable thing, I think, about this is that because you have to have all this stuff, I mean, you're getting a hold of David's weapons and you're getting the captains and the guards. And I mean, everyone, they must have really, really not liked this other queen. Like, it seems like they got a lot
That's
of people
what I'm
on board.
Too, yeah.
A lot of people are on board, and a lot of people kept their mouth shut.
Yeah, which is amazing. To keep this a secret, this is a well-oiled machine here, mm-hmm. well orchestrated. And for all this to happen and no one to whisper, you know, down the line to the queen mother that this was about to happen is probably the most remarkable part of the story, honestly.
Yeah,
Yeah,
and that's why when she comes and sees what's happening, that's why you know it's over. Because it's over, man. Her approval rating had to have been like really in the toilet for this to get organized like this. Yeah, and then, and you see, it's sort of weird if you think about what she did to be seated on the throne. What she cries out is wild, because she tears her clothes and cries out, "Treason, treason."
How dare they do something evil against the ruler of the land?
Yeah,
imagine that.
There's some hubris on that statement.
Yeah, this is like this is the pot calling the kettle black to the utter extreme.
Yeah, especially if this if the other pot isn't even black. Like, I mean, it's not even. Right. I mean, yeah, like, this is treasonous. No, it's not.
Right. Yeah, this is actually legitimate. This is like Jacob waking up complaining to Laban about how he had been deceived.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've never acted deceitfully in your life, have you?
Yeah.
So, she tears her clothes. Treason, treason. And joy to the priest. Yeah, he's got this all figured out. He tells the guards, basically, take her out of here. So bring her out between the ranks. Put to death with a sword anyone who follows her. You kind of get the impression nobody's following her. Mm. Like she's utterly alone. Anyone who might have considered following her is shrinking back and disappearing. And so he says, take her out, because it was holy ground, right? Let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord. So they grabbed her, laid hands on her, and took her through the horse's entrance to the king's house. And that's where she was executed. That's where she was put to death. You know, this is this whole, you know, child in danger, hide the child, keep the child safe for a while, bring the child out, the child becomes the leader of Israel. I mean, we've heard this story before,
yeah.
Right? I mean, this
yeah.
is yeah, this is the Moses story, for one. You know, they're in Egypt, all these kids are being killed, just like happened here. But Moses, you know, he's a baby. He's kept safe by mom for as long as possible until it's too late. You know, then he's brought out, and eventually, of course, he becomes the leader of Israel. So that's your kind of your backward looking typology. But then you got the same thing looking forward. You'll have Jesus born. You've got Herod's kind of murderous jealousy and fear. So he wipes out all the baby boys in Bethlehem. But one is saved. Christ is saved. He's whisked away to Egypt and then brought back to become King of Kings of Israel. So in an archetypical kind of way, this fits with other biblical stories that we've seen. So we have the queen mother who killed all these babies. She herself is executed. And then verse 17 tells us that Jehoiada made a covenant with three parties, which is kind of strange here. Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people that they should be the Lord's, Yahweh's people. And then also between the king and the people. In other words, what had been happening for a long time in the southern kingdom is the same thing that had been happening in the northern kingdom. You have them slouching more and more into idolatry. And this was largely, not completely, but largely due to the influence that was coming from places like Tyre and Sidon, which was the epicenter of the worship of Baal and Asherah. Well, you have the kings of the northern kingdom marrying princesses like Jezebel from there. And then you have the offspring of the king and queen in the northern kingdom marrying the kings in the south. So you've got this gradual flow of idolatry from north to south. And so it was time, kind of a Mount Carmel, Elijah and the people of Israel moment again, where it's like, all right, who's the true God, right? Who are we going to serve? Is it going to be Baal, or is it going to be Yahweh? So verse 17 tells us that we got a covenant between Yahweh and the king and the people, that they should be Yahweh's people. So we'll see how long this kind of treaty lasts and how much fidelity there is. As you probably could anticipate, the king, even though he does some great things, is still going to have his problems, because that is just kind of the old story of all of these kings of north as well as south.
Well, we got a new king, over here. He's young.
We got a second grader.
Hey, but you got a priest who seems to be sort of a mentor here. Like he's sort of gonna guide him along, and we have to see how that goes.
Yeah, it'll be good. I mean, as long as the priest is around, we'll see what happens when the priest is gone. We'll see how faithful the king remains after that.
That's right. All right, Chad. Well, I will see you next week.
All right, see you then.